Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Cloning has been around for a while, but now Chinese scientists have cloned primates. The technology that we've talked about on this program includes, remember Dr. John Sanford's gene gun, and then, of course, 3D printing. And we've talked about the CRISPR genome editing tool. There's even a machine at the University of Illinois that, by the press of a button, has automated the manufacture of all kinds of carbon molecules. So cloning primates, while brand new, has been on the horizon and presages what would be the horror of cloning human beings. To discuss the Chinese cloning of these monkeys, we'll speak with biologist Dr. Anne Gager, who's with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Gager is a senior fellow at the Center for Science and Culture there, and she's one of my favorite intelligent design scientists in the ID field who herself brings a molecular wrecking ball to neo-Darwinism. So, Anne Gager, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Glad to be here.
Well, Anne, you've earned your first degree in biology from MIT and then a PhD from the University of Washington, and you've even done cloning work as a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard. Your research has been published in the journal Nature, the Journal of Biological Chemistry, and in Development, so you're the real deal. It's an honor to have you on the program to discuss this cloning of these monkeys.
Well, I've been blessed by the opportunity to have the chance to study at those universities, really. Mm. I think it was God's provision.
So, Anne, perhaps we could get into the science of it a bit later. But to start with, one scientific question, what kind of technique did they use for this cloning?
They started with a monkey embryo and removed one of the cells from it, a fibroblast cell, mm-hmm. and took the nucleus, which is where the DNA is, out of that cell, and then transferred it to an egg that had no nucleus. So they're putting the fibroblast nucleus into the egg and then seeing if it will develop properly. They started with, I think, 112 eggs, and only 79 of them developed. Then they took the ones that developed and put them into female monkeys and waited to see which ones actually continued to develop. Mm. And the outcome was that only two survived to be born and to be healthy. In another set of experiments, they used more than 100 eggs, and they had a couple of monkeys be born but then die shortly thereafter.
Mm. So when we're talking about animals, of course, animals are not human beings. I also pastor a church, Denver Bible Church, and we teach that we're made in God's image and likeness. So it's one thing to do this, say, experiments on fetal pigs. It's a completely different thing to take human beings and use them as though they were just objects.
Exactly.
Owned property.
Exactly.
Yes. So we have a bit of audio from Reuters did a news report on this. And just to emphasize the immediacy of the concern, in the first, we have just 15 seconds that comes from the first half minute of their video. Let's hear this.
Macaque monkeys are primates, and Homo sapiens is a primate. So technically, you know, we've overcome a key barrier now, and in theory, there's no reason why this technique shouldn't be applied to humans. Question is the ethics.
So the ethics of it, Anne Gager, in Evolution News and Views, you have an article, Monkey Clones, Harbingers of Things to Come, and you wrote about an article you found while you were researching this story, And it begins, our number one priority is to deliver healthy, established, problem-free clones to your facility. And wow, it sounded scary as I was reading it. What was your reaction?
Well, my first reaction was, my God, you know, have they done it? And then I realized they were talking about cannabis clones, since it's from Oregon, of course.
Right.
But I was horrified. And then I imagined a day when such an advertisement might be written about human clones would be something right out of a science fiction novel.
Well, in science fiction, authors, as you give a summary of, they've been writing about this for, what, about 80 years now?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's been a big theme.
Yes, and of course, more famous examples are Superman 4 and Star Wars Attack of the Clones, but it goes all the way back to 1939. So the problem with cloning human beings, could you describe some of those concerns? There are so many.
We don't want to use human beings. We have come to the point where we recognize that slavery is a moral evil. Mm. That you can't own or use human beings as property. Mm. Yet cloning would do exactly that. It would use a human being, the result of cloning, mm-hmm. as a utilitarian object, something meant to be used by the owner in any way they desire. So it could be you could clone a human being because you want to have spare parts when you get old, mm. or you could clone a dead child or a lover. You could clone yourself to have a child, a younger version of yourself.
So when you're saying for spare parts, and for example, if parents have a child who's ill, they may clone one of themselves or another child and have a baby born in order to harvest the baby's heart or its lungs. Or
That's a possibility.
And that's along the lines of the motivation of current research with animal cloning. It's in that neighborhood.
For animal cloning, they want to use the clones for experimentation. So they're using the animals for their own purposes. They want to have animals that are copies of each other so they can eliminate variability in the experiments. Mm. I want to say that we need to be aware that humans are already being cloned, just not as reproductive cloning to produce living full-term infants, but rather as what we call therapeutic cloning, where they take the stem cells that result from the clone and then use them for experiments. So that's morally problematic as well, obviously. And it ties in with, this is where I get passionate, this using of human beings is the same thing that happens with abortion, euthanasia, where you devalue human life and say that you can use it as you will, whether in cloning or in abortion, is a moral evil that unfortunately our society has not realized. We dispose of people who are not useful to us anymore.
Well, to help the audience realize that what you're talking about is not just theoretical, I'd like to play another clip of audio. This is from Richard Dawkins. He was speaking with Peter Singer. I'm sure you're very well aware of both of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Singer is the so-called bioethicist at Princeton who's said that the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. And so Richard Dawkins, I think it's accurate to say he's the world's leading promoter of neo-Darwinism, of the theory of evolution. And so they were talking about infanticide, about whether or not it should be legal to kill a baby after it's born in the first year or two. So let's hear this.
The argument in favor of abortion up until the baby was 1 year old, say, or 2 years old. And so if a baby was 1 year old and turned out to have some horrible, incurable disease that meant it was going to die in agony in later life, what about infanticide? Morally, I strictly morally, I can see no objection to that at all. I would be in favor of infanticide.
So that's where we're at. And Ann Gager at American Right to Life's website, they have an article on infanticide. And it's horrific how many leaders and organizations have come out in favor of changing the law to allow post-birth abortion where you could commit infanticide and kill a baby. In fact, in the Journal of Medical Ethics, they argued that it should be legal to kill a baby after it's born for absolutely any reason.
Any reason.
Yeah, that's the Journal of Medical Ethics, After Birth Abortion, Why Should the Baby Live? And in fact, MIT's Steven Pinker wrote a three-page article published in the New York Times advocating that infanticide should be decriminalized. That's some time ago, but these are all documented at this American Right to Life page. So you're not exaggerating in the concern about using human beings as property and doing what you will with them.
Yep. We already struggle with organ trafficking and the sale of embryo parts, euthanasia and abortion. I have a disabled daughter, and the thought that someone would say to me that I should commit infanticide because she's disabled is horrifying.
Right.
How can a society survive if we create a class of humans that are not the product of love or desire, but as a means to an end for a purpose of use? It's just beyond words.
And before we continue talking about this particular cloning of these monkeys, how about chimera hybrids? The journal Nature has published an article pointing out that here in America, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, they've actually funded some research into chimera, but they're considering changing their policy so that they can do a lot more of that. These are hybrids like human pig or human bat, human kangaroo. This, when we talk about cloning and ending up with people who are just objects and they're brought into existence for spare parts, that's horrific. But this may even be more horrific. Is that a type of cloning, these hybrids?
No. What they do is they take cells from human embryo and cells from a pig embryo and mix them together, and they reform an embryo. And so you get a creature that's part human and part pig. Mm. And their goal there is to hope that the human cells end up in a part of the pig that makes a pancreas or a heart that can be used for transplantation or something like that. It is horrific. I think I've read about cases where they did create hybrids and then were worried that they might have been part of the brain, so they terminated it.
So
but the pig is real. The pig is real.
So you write about in the history of cloning, when researchers took a salamander nucleus and put it into a frog egg. And so I was under the impression that they are taking sometimes an animal ovum and an enucleated animal ovum and putting a human nucleus in that. Do you think that's perhaps not happening and not happening yet?
Certainly not in a frog egg. I'm sure somebody's trying it somewhere. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's no legal barrier on the federal level in this country and in other countries around the world. And if they don't have moral center that would say to them, this is wrong, don't, then they're going to go ahead. Mm. And in fact, some of the most striking cloning events have happened in places like Korea and China.
Mm-hmm. There have been reports that you document in your article of claimed human cloning, but it seems that those reports were not credible, even though one was from a professor at the University of Kentucky, and there's a cult group, the Raelians. But the few reports that human cloning has been accomplished, they've not been widely accepted.
Yeah, disputed is definitely the word.
Right.
I don't think they're probably true. This is the subject. What motivates scientists to do this kind of thing? It's to be the first to do it, and also to do something new that nobody's ever done before. And sometimes curiosity figures in. So these people that you mentioned that are involved in claiming human cloning, that's why they would do it. They want to be the first. They want to have fame and notoriety.
Right. So, Anne, could you help us understand the now more of the molecular challenges to cloning a primate? You lay out the history of cloning, which in and of itself in your article is fascinating, and it goes way back to the 1800s, which really surprised me, 1885. Can we start there, come forward, and then talk about why this took so long to clone primates?
Okay. Hans Driesch was the first scientist to successfully, what he did was he took sea urchin embryos and shook them, and they came apart into single cells and discovered that each cell could develop into an adult, I think up to 8-cell stage. So that told everybody that those cells had the necessary information to grow into an adult. Although, I have to say, they were little miniature adults, not full-sized.
Okay.
Then in 1902, the same thing was done with vertebrates, which was much trickier. You had to use a little hair and divide the cells. And then he had to wait till 1952 when they transferred a nucleus to a new empty egg and got, that's the salamander experiment that you talked about. That says that the nucleus directs what kind of development happens. Mm. And the two species are close enough in relationship so that they share factors in the cytoplasm that would work together with the nucleus. It is the case that if you go too far afield, like a frog into a human egg, it won't work, just because the two creatures are too different. Then moving ahead to 1958, not long after, another scientist did the same thing, but this time taking adult nucleus into adult eggs with frogs. So you see there's a steady progression of the kinds of things they're doing, and they're asking questions about what role the nucleus is playing in development. Now, the first mammalian transfer happened in 1975, and it only went to embryonic development and never made it past that.
All right.
In 1984, sheep embryos were cloned by nuclear transfer using a sort of an electronic zap to get the nucleus inside the egg. And those cloned embryos developed all the way into 3 live lambs.
And that's bringing us toward Dolly.
We're working our way there.
Okay.
1987, they did it with cows. Cows, it turns out, are particularly easy to clone.
And it would be especially economically valuable, I think, that a number of ranchers would presume.
In fact, that is the case. They clone cows routinely and bulls routinely because they want to preserve their favorite stock and have, you know, the same cow that behaves and produces the right milk. It's already in use commercially.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, in 1996, along comes Dolly, and she was a sheep that was cloned using adult cells as the nuclear donor. She's the first mammal that was cloned that way.
So is that why she made all the headlines and was so famous? Because this stuff had been going on in different ways for almost 100 years, but with Dolly, they're taking an adult, which really anything beyond a fetus, I think they might consider an adult. And then you could select an adult and then clone it. And so this is being done now in mammals. And wow, that seemed to point to the possibility of humans being cloned.
Yes, it created quite a stir. There was a lot of debate. Several presidents created panels, bioethics panels, to ask this question, and one was Clinton, one was George W. Bush. So you can see that over several administrations, this was debated. Mm. Both panels recommended no cloning, that we restrict it. Now, here's the thing that I didn't know. I remember the debate. I remember the recommendations. I assumed they'd acted on it and passed laws. They did not.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation, the House passed it and took it to the Senate where it died.
And we were on the air at the time, and very often what we would think is happening in Washington, because it's so just thoroughly needed and obvious and essential, then those things don't happen. I remember with the funding of embryonic stem cell research, even that, the memory, the corporate memory that even pro-lifers have of that is not really accurate, because George W. Bush became the first president to fund embryonic stem cell research. He put some restrictions on it, but he actually became the first to fund embryonic stem cell research. You're saying in this case that Congress took up the idea of human cloning, but that they did not pass a law banning human cloning.
That's right.
Wow.
There is no federal law banning any form of cloning, including reproductive cloning.
Wow.
There are some states that have passed laws, but that's a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say in my article, the regulatory environment is so full of holes you could drive a truck through it of experiments. It's just,
right.
It's not just here, it's in other countries. There are a few countries that have banned cloning, period, but that's, you need to just go some other place and do it.
Well, the scientist in China who cloned these monkeys, he said that we would never, ever clone a human being. But he's older. You know, even if that's his own personal morality, there's no restriction on that in China. And certainly there are 1,000 other scientists who would go boldly where he ends up stopping.
Last night, I spent some time looking at websites involved in bioethics where they debate this issue, and they list pros and cons. The cons are some of the ethics questions. There's some of the things we've already said about the ethics of it. The pros are all about the benefits we could achieve by using these clones. So there are people who argue for even reproductive cloning.
Mm. Well, spare parts and spare workers, talk about cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
You mention, and you're a biologist, and you seem to work not at the level of the full anatomy, but down in the molecules. Are you more of a molecular biologist?
Yeah, molecular and cellular. But I also did developmental biology for my PhD, so I have some familiarity of development.
Okay.
Process.
So let's say in the area of molecular biology, when you're studying the nuts and bolts of these organisms, you've probably never come across a soul, right, in a microscope. You've probably never seen one of those. But in your article, you very wisely bring up the question whether or not a cloned human being would even have a soul. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, and even non-Christian cultures for thousands of years have recognized there's something beyond the material in human beings and even in animals. And we teach that plants have a body, and that's it, and that animals can have a body and a soul. In other words, you can have a relationship with your horse or your dog or your cat at some level, but human beings have a body, soul, and spirit, we teach, the Bible teaches. And so if you were to clone a human being, we have no idea what we are doing to this eternal creature who's coming into existence. We have no idea.
No. Well, my particular faith teaches that God infuses the soul at the moment of conception. I think out of graciousness, he would do the same for any clone.
Thank
so that
you.
Means that all clones that are produced are individuals that are being used. It's just as bad as the experiments of Mengele in mm-hmm. Auschwitz or any of the other concentration camps. It's as bad as genocide. It's bad as I run out of horrors to express. what we do when we destroy these clones by experimentation.
Yeah, human dignity, when you lose that, it's reprehensible what happens. And if I could just comment, thank you for sharing what you did about your faith, which is different from the scientific work you do. At Denver Bible Church, we teach that God created Adam and Eve and that he gave them the ability to procreate. He created, we procreate. And so whether it's in the commission of a crime or whether it's in the context of a beautiful marriage, that a child's soul, spirit, everything the child is, comes from the parents. So that God ceased from his creative work, and now we have the ability to procreate. Obviously, this is speculation, but one way or the other, bringing into existence human beings and then discarding the sacredness of what it means to be a human being is just, it's bringing us to a dark place in history that we've never seen before.
I agree. You can take it further. Anytime we monkey with reproduction, pardon the pun, we are treading in sacred ground. The way God made us to reproduce, to have offspring, is a wonderful and sacred thing. And it's not meant to be disrupted and divided and turned into an experiment. Mm.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Ann Gager, for joining us here on Real Science Radio. It's a horrific topic, but I'm thankful that we can talk to somebody who knows the science and the morality of what's happening. And for people to follow your work, what's the best way they can do that?
Well, I write for Evolution News, which is evolutionnews.org. You can also go to Discovery Institute website, discovery.org, and then the Center for Science and Culture. At evolutionnews.org, there is a list. You can click on authors, and then there will be a drop-down, and my name will be there. All the articles I've written are there.
All right. Well,
I've also contributed to a book called Science and Human Origins. It's getting a little old. The information we've got now has grown considerably, so we're going to have to do a rewrite soon. But those are two places to look. And we have a brand-new book out.
Theistic Evolution.
Yeah, Theistic Evolution, a scientific, philosophical, and theological critique. We're critiquing the idea that you can have a Christian faith and also hold on to the idea that evolution is how God created us. If you believe that God created us through evolution by a guided process, then you fall into the camp of intelligent design, if you believe it can be detected. But if you believe that evolution is the explanation for everything we see, and God had nothing to do with it, you're what's called a theistic evolutionist. So we argue against it in the book, from a scientific point of view, philosophical and theological. The science section is quite large. It includes a lot of famous names, important scientists. And then the philosophical section, the same. And the theological. Some of the other editors, J.P. Moreland, Stephen Meyer, Chris Shaw and Wayne Grudem, and I'm one of them as well. And then my main contribution, which may be of interest, since we're on the subject of human origins, is that topic. I contributed two chapters, one on the genetic differences between chimps and humans, and one on whether it's possible scientifically to claim that we came from two first people, Adam and Eve, instead of 10,000, which is the scientific claim right now.
Yeah, even Christianity Today, the magazine founded by Billy Graham, argues that we have come from either a couple thousand or more ape-like creatures, which then were endowed with a human soul. So that is a growing belief in Christian circles, I think, tragically.
Yeah, and especially theistic evolutionists. Circles.
Yes, and theistic evolution, there was an equal time conference at Pepperdine University put on by alumni because the school has gone to theistic evolution, and I was asked to speak there. We have a fun video on that on our YouTube channel, but we pointed out that evolution, the only real non-negotiable that the evolutionists have is that it has to be a non-directed process. Almost everything else is up for grabs. But theistic evolution, if they want God to be involved in the direction of evolution, it's like inherently contradictory. You can't have a directed, undirected process. And so it seems to be a non-starter from the beginning.
That phrase, you can't have a directed, undirected process, is in the book several times.
Awesome.
So what we try and do is demonstrate where the problems are with evolution so Christians can understand that logically it doesn't make sense to think we came by an undirected process. Mm-hmm. And then we try and provide philosophical support for why intelligent design is a reasonable scientific approach. And we answer questions about why philosophy is necessary for science. It's a really interesting book.
When was it published?
The end of November of last year.
Okay, great. Because I haven't seen
it. Put out by Crossway.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll have to get a copy. I'm sure you guys deal with Francis Collins and his BioLogos group.
You know, I don't know that they're mentioned by name very often. We do that on the web in our articles. Mm-hmm. Oh, one other thing. You know this question of whether we came from 10,000 or two?
Yes.
Dennis Venema, who is a prominent participant at BioLogos, wrote a book called Adam and the Genome, along with Scott McKnight, I think it is, who's a theologian. And he argued the case for why we had to come from 10,000 and basically said there is no such thing as Adam and Eve. Now, along comes a British scientist who is eminently qualified, and he says to Dennis, I'm not sure you're right there. I think you're exceeding what the evidence says. And they go into a big debate. This is on the BioLogos website.
Okay.
You can find the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets pretty technical. And then along comes another population geneticist, famous man from the Broad Institute named Steve Schaffner. And he says, all right, I'm going to test this. I'm going to run some models. And he does. And he finds out that past 500,000 years ago, they cannot rule out a first couple.
Wow.
Now, that's shocking.
Yeah.
Because they've said all along, it's not possible.
Right, right.
500,000 years ago, we can't rule it out.
All right.
And a scientist comes along, and he does it his own way, and he says, well, actually, past 340,000 years ago, we can't rule it out. Now, in our book, we have a chapter where we describe our own model, not making the same assumptions that evolutionists do, namely common descent. And we're going to run our own model. We're in the process of programming it now. And it's programmed and it's being transferred to supercomputers so we can really do a good job.
Wow.
We're going to run our own model, starting with two, and test whether we can generate the modern genetic diversity that we see in human populations. If we can do it, starting with two, we'll have shown them, look, you can't make these claims. You can't say it's not possible.
Yeah, and I have been collecting articles published in the journal Nature and elsewhere where they'll look at some particular group and they'll say, we could explain virtually all the genetic diversity of this group, and then they'll give a number of generations, like in 200 generations. They'll say that. And it turns out that there is a theme going on that researchers are shocked by how rapidly they could explain genetic diversity. That's the theme.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, and we're out of time, but it's a thrill to talk to you here at Real Science Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And for the audience, you could also find Anne's work at our website, rsr.org/gager. That's rsr.org/gauger. This is Bob Inyart for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real
talking about.